Hello and welcome to another For Your Consideration. With me, as ever, is my co-host, Michael. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Luke.
We are recording this on April the 1st, and it should be going out on April the 6th, Bank Holiday Monday, if I can edit it in time. In the meantime, on the morning of Friday the 3rd, I've been
Saturday.
Led to believe... It was going to be Saturday, it's now going to be the Friday. Two episodes of the Daleks Master Plan will drop that neither of us have seen before. Episodes 1 and 3. Are you excited, Michael?
You know what? I am. I'm actually more excited than I suspected I would be. Hartnell's not my favourite Doctor, but that's probably because I just wasn't there and you never got to watch them and... There was all that hassle of having to read the Target novelizations and stuff like that. But it's a Dalek story. And you know me, I like a good Dalek. Well, I like a bad Dalek story. I just like a Dalek story. I am the predictable Doctor Who fan. I like that sort of thing. So yeah, when they were like, oh, we found some episodes. Have you? Okay, then. And I am reasonably excited because... They're new to me, and also I don't really think I've actually seen the other episodes of Dalek Master Plan, the ones that do exist.
Okay.
So I know we've got five. I think I did the audio book and I read the novelization, but I just didn't really fancy doing that whole telesnaps, you know, slog.
Especially with
them not really existing. And
I'm not one for the telesnaps, but I like to listen to the soundtracks with the...
Yeah,
with the narration. That's my preferred method of missing episodes. I mean, I like the animations as well, but so it's going to be very exciting. I had literally got to the end of The Mythmakers in my big Doctor Who marathon.
No.
And the morning that the news was announced, and I was like, oh, what do I do now? Do I pause?
Yeah.
Or do I do the whole of the Daleks Master Plan at the end of March and then... Watch the new recovered episodes. I decided to pause.
So what did you go with? You've paused.
Paused. Yeah. So I've had a few weeks pause between listening to the end of The Mythmakers and then Friday will be Dalek's Master Plan.
This revisiting and the pilgrimage, that's what everyone calls it.
Yes.
And this specific pilgrimage, was there a motivation behind it or was it just kind of it's time,
well,
let's do it again?
I've just never done it. So aside from the key to time and the Trial of a Time Lord,
yeah.
I did Troughton. For some reason I did Troughton when my daughter was small and I was up in the mornings and watching stuff. So I've done the whole of the Troughton era and I've done the key to time and I've done the Trial of a Time Lord. But other than that, before this, I've not watched Doctor Who in order. It was always dip in, here's a VHS, here's a DVD, here's a Target book. So I've never done the pilgrimage. I've never done the whole sweep of Doctor Who in order.
Nice.
So that was, I was like, I should finally get round to doing it. So I have. It's great. I'm loving it. I love the Hartnell era, so it's very exciting. But we have now hit season 3, which is more difficult because of most of it being missing. Less of it being missing now, which is very exciting.
There was a really good thing on Radio Free Scorer this week where they were talking to the guy from Film is Fabulous.
Yes.
And they were talking about this magical new range of lost episode of where they could have come from.
Yes.
This technical copy thing.
Yeah.
And I must admit, I was kind of enraptured by the whole thing. I was like, good Lord, there's more. There's a whole extra level of background.
Yes. Well, there's also the fact that and it's obviously a bit of a tease, is that they know for definite that there are other episodes in private hands.
Yeah.
But they aren't immediately under threat due to somebody about to die. Like,
and
as was the case with this one.
Looking after them as well. It's like we're going to look at the most, you know, in danger collections first.
So it's exciting to know that there are more out there. It's just, when
it
are we going to get them?
That I'm absolutely going to have to start looking after myself on a health front just in order to sort of live to see more episodes.
Well, the slightly bittersweet thing I feel, I don't know whether this has occurred to you, but it certainly occurred to me, is that this was the first missing episode recovery since Siobhan died.
Yeah, and it was the first Doctor.
And it was the first Doctor story, so just a little bit sad on Siobhan's behalf. And obviously there have been plenty of fans have passed away who, you know, won't get to see this. So, yeah, but I'm very excited, very excited. And I'm hearing good things, and it's Douglas Camfield, so, you know.
Exactly. What's not to like? And they'll be on iPlayer, so basically if you can convince your computer that you are
in the UK,
you can watch it anywhere in the world, which is fair and lovely and gorgeous. I still think the BBC are missing a trick. Okay. In order to make iPlayer work, you should input your TV license number.
Yes.
Okay. Therefore, rather than just go, yeah, I've got a license, which is what you have to do at the minute. Okay. So imagine that you put it in. Therefore, anybody in the world who wants to pay for the iPlayer could just pay a license fee.
Well, they did that, though, didn't they? They did an international iPlayer, and they did an international iPlayer briefly, and it didn't garner what they wanted it to garner.
Was it
apparently
just the people from like Radio Free Score or paying for it, no one else?
I suspect so. Anyway,
sorry, I'm just.
We can talk more about it once we've seen them.
I know.
Today we are.
We should do a watch party, maybe. It's 6 a.m. We just look like death.
You have chosen a Disney film that I had not heard of before, called Atlantis: The Lost Empire.
I certainly did.
This is from 2001?
Yep, that's what my notes say. Yep,
okay, so I would have been 17, which is probably why it passed me by, because, I mean, to be fair, I didn't watch a lot of Disney when I was a kid, but certainly stuff that was coming out when I was in my late teens, I'm oblivious to. How did you first encounter it? Tell us about the backstory of the film.
Give me a second. 2001, I am, 29.
Right.
28, 29. I just wanted to see it. There's no exciting backstory. It was about the time when I was just going to the cinema a lot.
Right.
And I liked animated films. We'd already had the 2D revival of Disney at this point. So we'd had Aladdin. This is towards the end of the very good 2D stuff. But Disney was known for songs, princesses, and that's kind of your direction. Obviously, you've got The Lion King's the big bump. You've got The Lion King and Aladdin are the big, yay, we're Disney, we're doing really well again. But then you've got Tarzan. You've got Brother Bear, which are perfectly good films. You've got Hunchback of Notre Dame, right? So now that's problematic at best, that storyline, in order to convert it into a proper Disney film. But by this point, they're going, right, we're going to try something different, something new. So Disney comes along and they say, right, we're going to do it in, I believe, well, is it anamorphic? It's massively long, right, and thin. It's proper cinema. It's not just 16:9 or any of the smaller standards that they were doing. Disney's model at the time was to produce a movie, and then to produce either a spin-off straight to video or some TV episodes and a series that would come after it. That was kind of the working model at the time, but things were about to change. So then,
because I noticed there was a direct-to-DVD sequel a couple of years later, right?
Which I watched this morning, Milo's Return, and it does feel very much like three episodes of a TV series that was cancelled, pushed together.
Oh, okay.
Because the animation, it's not as good. But it is still very good. But there's definite the sweeping vistas of Atlantis itself are mostly done either in CG or with a lot of CGI assist going on.
Right.
And as soon as you get to the sequel, it's like, pass me the pens and pencils and the paper, and I'll be drawing them. And Atlantis looks just as well, looks good. But it is definitely a much smaller scale entity than this. I mean, it was predicted for this film. It wasn't a critical or financial success, right? Well, I'll put my cards on the table. I love it. I saw it at the cinema. I was absolutely blown away, and I was like, oh my God, Disney's growing up. Disney's becoming like a fantastic animation art house. It's going to be superb. And the reality was, everyone else just wanted princesses and songs and more of the same. And I was kind of on my own. But yesterday I was on Twitter and there was a guy, and I was just scrolling through, it was doom scrolling, and somebody had watched every single theatrical release Disney movie and he'd put them in order. And there was God tier, and it was all the way down to basically some episodes of a TV show, all the way down. And there was two films at the top, and one of those was Atlantis. Arguably the best movie ever made. Right, that was the category.
What was his other one?
I am desperately trying to remember. I will find out, and I will put it in the show notes. But there was some stuff I didn't agree with. Right, there was definitely some stuff halfway down. I was like, that's not right. But you know, because I would have put Ralph Breaks the Internet considerably higher than he had it. He had it down as quite low. And so I've got. I'd say 90% of the Disney big movies, you know, the ones that had the theatrical releases, especially the animated ones. I haven't seen as many of the live action stuff. I've never seen Something Wicked This Way Comes, and I've tried to read the book about 400 times and made it about 10 pages in. I've made it further, but you know what I mean. I've not seen the live action stuff as much. Obviously, stuff like Tron and The Black Hole are arguably much more. There's a lot more animation going on than you know what I mean. It's effects heavy, and I know I grew up with The Spaceman and King Arthur, or whatever it's called in the country that you happen to be in. So I'm familiar with the live action stuff, but this just spoke to me. I just really liked it. It had a whole 20,000 Leagues feel to it. This sort of predates the what we're going to call the steampunk revolution that happened kind of just after this, so it was on the cusp of that. But steampunk movies have got a very hit and miss tradition. Everyone just goes, yeah, I really like 20,000 Leagues. It's like, it's science, but it's not science of the time. But then you've got the biggest clunker of all time, which is Wild Wild West, which on paper looks great, but the reality is, okay, mate. So steampunk's got a bit of a rough ride, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, that kind of thing. So this kind of fits more into that. And apparently it takes place in, 1914? So it's the cusp of the First World War is when this is set. And also,
which is largely irrelevant to the plot, apart from that moment near the end where somebody references selling the assorts.
Let's sell it to the Kaiser.
Yeah. So but otherwise, it doesn't feel like it matters when it's set, right?
Well, it doesn't, because the Milo's Return, I've just remembered, there's actually a storyline in that with W. Morgan Shepherd, who we've dealt with Max Edrum. He's voicing this guy who's got delusions of grandeur and thinks he's Thor or Odin or something.
Right.
It's Odin. That's it. And he's having a breakdown while thinking he can control ancient gods or something.
Right.
It's not connected, but the guy says, oh, yeah, he used to be a shipping magnate, but he lost all of his money in the Depression. I'm thinking, what, the Depression that happens in 15 years' time? Okay. Yeah, like, you know, in the Wall Street crash, I suppose it's not 15 years, but you know what I mean? It's like, it's the 20s when that happens. So it's after this. So, yeah. But we don't know how long the gap is, because Milo stays in Atlantis at the end of the first movie. And at the spin-off, they journey back to the surface to find some Atlantean artifacts that are affecting the world. Also,
I mean, is he therefore imbued with some of the longevity of Atlantis by having stayed there?
Yeah, they all are. Yeah, because at the end, with the crystals being given to, well, let's call a spade a spade, to Fraser's dad, he gets given one of the crystals. He starts feeling younger as well. They all do. They all start. So I suppose it's a bit vague when it's set later.
Yeah.
Also, cards on the table. Obviously, I've gone on about this forever. Favorite game of all time, Call of Cthulhu. It's like, it's strange creatures under the water. It's underground societies, is other religion. It's got echoes of that going on as well for this. So that's one of the reasons this film just spoke to me. And I really like the animation style as well. That's kind of it. So I just thought, you know what? I enjoyed that. It's not your normal Disney fare. Let's bring it to the table and see what you thought. So that was it.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much not your normal Disney fare. It's interesting how much death there is in it.
Yeah.
that was something that occurs more often. But I did look it up. The BBFC has it as a U.
Yeah.
I know you sent it to me, but we did actually have another month of Disney Plus, so we watched it on Disney Plus, and on Disney Plus it's rated as 12 plus now.
Okay.
But specifically because of the character who smokes.
I love that. Well, we've got massive death and destruction. We've got an entire universe being wiped out and a whole society being wiped out, but somebody smokes.
Somebody
better smoke. Watch yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I was a bit nonplussed by the whole affair, to be honest.
That's fine.
It was visually very impressive, and I liked the mixture of CG elements, but with obviously all 2D rendered, and you know the sweep of the whole thing, the epic nature of it was you know really impressive. And what I did like about the film was the characters. There are certain characters who feel like they make like Helga initially makes an impact, and then she's largely sort of sidelined for the rest of the film, which I thought was disappointing.
It is considering it's Claudia Christie.
Well.
Yeah.
I had to look her up because I was like, I recognise the voice. I don't know why I recognise the
voice. I thought you would have got that straight off.
I got that I knew the voice immediately.
Yeah, fair enough.
Like, immediately when she spoke, I was like, oh, I know this voice. But my brain did not supply me with who it was. And then I looked her up and I was like, of course it is. The other thing that I found, and you, tell me what you thought about this.
Mm-hmm.
Two characters, but James Garner's character.
Yeah.
He sounded so much like Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, right. Now, there's an issue here. Right, okay. This is where the 10 years difference in our ages kicks in.
Right.
Because I knew him... Right, I know he's most famous for playing the original TV Maverick, okay, which I didn't watch. But the other major role he's famous for is Jim Rockford. And we were huge Rockford Files fans. Well, my grandma was. Whenever I would stay, it would always be on. And, you know, that whole thing with Answerphone. And it was Jim Rockford and then there was Quincy. They were the big sort of detective-y type things with my grandma's house. And so I knew him from that. So in my head, it was like that. But I can totally see the Tommy Lee Jones voice.
The thing is that I know him from The Great Escape, which is obviously like 40 years earlier. And so his voice has obviously aged. In the time, and I was watching it going, well, that sounds really like Tommy Lee Jones, and then I looked it up and I was like, oh, it's James Garner. I was like, okay, I can just about hear that's James Garner.
Yeah,
you know, and then I was like, oh, well, maybe actually on reflection they have similar voices in a sense, but I guess I'm just used to his voice when it was a lot younger. The other thing, and this is one of those, this is a whole conversation. I mean, I'd be interested in your perspective on this. But I found Michael J. Fox just a little bit distracting.
Yeah. See, that is at its core. In fact, we've actually just named the issues with the thing, right? Because it's kind of stunt casting. It's like, look, we can get all these people who do voices to do this.
Yeah.
And Disney traditionally, what they've done before and after this, is not hire big names to be the names in it. It's almost like when they hired... Well, I know they didn't hire Batman to be in Howl's Moving Castle, but we've discussed that one here as well.
Yeah.
So you get for sort of famous names to do the voices on the redub, but these are the famous people that they got in to do that, and they're all actors known for their human performances.
Yeah. Because have you ever seen Home... Well, you said you haven't
seen... This is the first thing that Michael J. Fox does after he gets his diagnosis.
Right. Well, okay. Have you ever seen Homeward Bound?
Is that the animals trying to get across
America? Yeah, so it's live action, but obviously they've given the dogs and the cat voices.
Right? Okay.
And Michael J. Fox is the young dog, right? And that works for me. I don't know.
Okay.
I know, maybe it was just because at the time I saw it, I knew it was Michael J. Fox, but I didn't at all connect the fact that he's playing this big Dalmatian, I think it is, with Marty McFly. Whereas watching this, I was just like, I just can't get past the fact that it's Michael J. Fox. And Michael J. Fox does not look like...
Milo.
Yeah. Milo. Most of the other characters, Leonard Nimoy, I think Leonard Nimoy was... I knew it was Leonard Nimoy.
Oh my God,
again, he wasn't Spockish. And no. That character just worked for me. But there was just something about Michael J. Fox where I was like, no, this is just, it's Michael J. Fox. And I know that there are certainly people who make their bread and butter out of being a voice artist on animation. You don't know what they look like.
Yeah.
And so it's the woman thing when
there's one woman who does like about 15 different characters she does like Raven and she does like My Little Pony. She does Shadow. And she looks, she doesn't look like any of the characters, obviously, because they're so different.
Mm.
But you're like, oh my God, how good is she? But then there was the guy who did Batman and he was like, yeah, you're Batman. That's it. And everyone just goes, yeah, you're the best Batman. The animated one from the 1990s.
He died recently, didn't he?
Yeah. I want to say Kevin. No.
It's Kevin something.
Yeah. Anyway, he was the best voice for Batman. But,
right.
So I get it. So voice actors, perhaps it needs to be redubbed with people we don't know.
I don't know. But having said that, the thing that I liked about the film was the characters.
Yeah.
Right? You know, in spite of the fact that Michael J. Fox was a bit distracting, I liked Milo. You know, I warmed to him as a person. The ensemble, like the doctor, he was pretty particularly funny. You know, there were humorous moments. And Mrs. What's-her-face, who's on the radio, she's on the phone, but also she's kind of like monitoring all the stuff on the ship. Like that was quite funny.
And I don't think it's the one from Monsters, Inc. I don't think it's the voice of, but the character's so similar.
Yes.
I've not made that
connection. I mean, it's the same year, actually, to Monsters, Inc. came out.
Yeah, exactly. Look at the difference in it, but yeah.
But yeah, I think where the film lost me largely was that I wasn't particularly invested in the plot.
Well, yeah, exactly. That is very much, it's down. Well, I think its downfall comes about half an hour in.
Wow, okay.
There's a gigantic, well, hang on. The issue with this is the same issue that Brothers Grimm's got. It's got an emotional, impressive, huge battle in the wrong place.
Right.
Because that Leviathan taking on the Ulysses submarine.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my God, it's going to be like 20,000 leagues under the sea. Here's a brilliant submarine coming out of another ship and it's all, oh, what a brilliant thing. And then you're like, oh, it's been destroyed.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay. What? And it was that giant Leviathan thing, that big monster, and it was and it's the emotional journey of that. It's such a huge epic battle. It's like putting the giant squid at the beginning of or the middle of 20,000 Leagues, which I guess they kind of, yeah. But you know what I mean?
Yes.
Can you see where I'm going with that? In Brothers Grimm, there's a gigantic tree that comes alive and fights them, and you're like, this is the fight from the end of the movie. And it's in the middle,
yeah,
and you can't get you can't get back from that,
yeah.
But that's because you're expecting a certain type of narrative, and that's not what you're getting. And I understand because then they've got no way of escaping. They've got to go on. He's got to become part of the team. But then they're like, yeah, but these vehicles aren't as cool as the massive giant submarine was. I'm probably wrong. I don't know.
No.
That's where it falls. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm just saying I enjoyed it. I wanted to share.
No, I don't think it was that. I guess what I found slightly implausible about it was the fact that they'd forgotten how to read their own language, and yet Milo could read it. That felt a little bit off.
Yeah, I get
then,
that.
And then the fact that like they'd forgotten how to use their technology. And there's all these like speeders, speeders just lying around. All you have to do is you just have to put the crystal in the right place, and it works. And you're like, and that again, it's only when he turns up that they kind of figure that out. And I suppose the other bit that really didn't make any sense to me was when they, you know, her mother had been selected in the past, but there wasn't really any explanation as to kind of what the cataclysm was.
To me, go on.
And then she gets selected.
Mm.
And then the thing comes down almost as if it wants them to steal it. And I was just like, it's supposed to be pretend. I didn't really follow what was happening at that point. 100%
correct on that one. It looks visually, it looks great. And then
we are
Doctor Who fans, so we're going to question stuff. We're going to go, but what's going on there? No, surely Why are the faces dropping? I mean, it looks great that these massive faces are falling out of the sky onto the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
But what's it all about? Which one was her mother? And I don't get that. And surely our mother should turn back from stone.
That was one of the things that, like, emotionally, you kind of felt that her mother should have reappeared at some point.
Yeah. Or even if it was to take the spirit of the old king away.
Yeah, or something. Yeah, something.
Or like something that. Along those lines. You know, it's like, come and join us, become a stone face or something. Yeah. Rather than just where they carve one at the end and he just flies and goes in a big circle. It's a bit like, I think it's possibly been made by people who've seen Akira too many times.
Right.
Because they've gone, right, it's got to have some sort of really impressive, impactful, sort of explodey type things going on.
Yes.
And because the creatures look like, the big stone giants look a lot like the robots from Laputa. So this has definitely been watched by people who've exposed themselves to a lot of international animation,
right,
which is kind of good because a lot of the mainstream American public won't have seen those things that they're referencing, that they're stealing from, that they're borrowing, that they're being influenced by. I mean, a huge influence on this film is the comics of Hellboy. And the Hellboy movies weren't really a thing at this point. You know, but the little dots that appear, the big square chunky hands, the design, it feels very much like Mingola? I can never say his surname. His artwork is a huge influence on this as well.
Right.
I'll tell you the story about buying the DVD later on, and because that's a very, very me story. But on the audio track, they describe how they were finding it very difficult to get it past Disney and just go, look, we're going to make this film, and they're going, yeah, but you want to make it in anamorphic, you don't want to make it really wide. A really wide, proper cinematic movie. And they went, well, what's the problem with that? They went, we haven't got the paper. And they went, what do you mean? To make a really wide screen film, you need wide paper. And they went, no, we'll use the same size paper, but we'll only use a little bit in the middle.
Yeah.
And Disney went, oh, yeah, we'll do that. So if ever you're trying to describe what formats are for people and the size of screens and things, that is a story that's actually on the DVD soundtrack. Originally there was a different opening, which they've made and is animated and is on Disney Plus. There's an entirely different prologue involving Vikings trying to find Atlantis with the Shepherd's Journal and it being destroyed. And on all the test screenings, they went, no. So they had to make that whole new bit about Plato and the destruction of Atlantis at the beginning, just to get you going, just like a Thunderbirds episode where something exciting happens to get you through the first 10 minutes of something boring. They had to have something incredibly impactful, like Akira losing her mum, emotionally, in order to get you through, because it's an old trick and it just works. So,
wow, yes.
I'm shopping with my parents. I'll tell you the story now. It's quick. It's very quick. Shopping with my parents. It's late at night. I'm out. It's like one of those times where we all go shopping at like midnight because there's nobody out. Because that's the sort of exciting thing I did in the early 2000s. And do you remember when you could buy DVDs in like Morrison's and Tesco's? So we're in Morrison's. Mm-hmm.
You still can, Michael.
Yeah, but it's not the same. Anyway, so I go over and I'm like, oh my God, Atlantis is out. And they've got the collector's edition DVD, two discs. Oh, can't help myself. And they're like, oh, it's nearly your birthday. Let's get it. So I pick it up. And I go to the till, and it's got a massive Morrison's, I think it was 2 for $20 or something. They had the wrong sticker on it, basically.
Right.
Right. And it was
you
a
mean
sticker
it should have
on...
been full price.
Exactly, yeah. So I was probably getting that and something else, because I was, me and a bargain. Hey, what's it going to say? Anyway, but it comes in a cardboard slipcase that looks like the Shepherd's Journal. It's a thing of beauty. When my wife was getting rid of all of the DVD boxes, I know, don't judge. When she was getting rid of the boxes and keeping the discs, I was like, I'll just put that one over there. And it's and saved that one because it's a thing of beauty, right? But it had a big, massive bargain. No, it had, just had the price tag on it. That was it. It was round and had a price tag. And I got to the till and I went, have you got one without the price tag sticker on it? Because I know they do. They've got them in the box underneath. Yeah. They had a big drawer, the drawer of gorgeousness. Pull the drawer out, get the one out that doesn't have a price tag on it. You can have that one. Can I have that one? She went, "What do you mean?" I went, "Well, it's got a sticker on it." And she went, "Oh, sorry, I'll just take the sticker off." And she peeled the sticker off, and the you know, there's like a layer of like clear plastic on top of a cardboard cut. Basically, if you buy an expensive cardboard box,
yes,
sometimes it's got a shiny cover to it,
yes,
which you could peel off. The shiny bit, the round bit, came off with a sticker, and she put it through the till. I went, "I'm not having that." She went, "Well," I went, "well, you've damaged the box." She went, "Well, I took the sticker off." I went, no, look, you can see here, if I held it up to the light, this bit's missing now. Right? And this is midnight. And she actually said to me, and this is why I remembered, "Well, you are joking." And I went, I just looked at her like I was Paddington giving a hard stare. I went, "No. I want one that isn't, no. No." So anyway,
somebody went and presumably were like, "Well, this is just Michael being Michael."
Yes, obviously. It's Michael in his DVDs, his glorious DVD collection.
I had a conversation with somebody the other day, and I said to them, I was like, I hate to be snobby, but like, if anybody gives me a film on DVD these days, I'm disappointed, because if it's a film, I want it on Blu-ray. And this person looked at me like I had two heads.
Hey. You've not gone out, and you, I don't know, actually, I've not spoken to you about this. Have you ordered the Paul McGann film in 4K or Blu-ray?
I haven't, because I'm debating which version to get, because we talked about 4K drives. I think if you want a 4K drive and you want to be able to rip it, you need to be spending a couple of hundred quid. And I'm like, yes, I don't, it's not worth it. But equally, you know that it's going to be available in 4K.
Well, it's a steelbook. I ordered it in 4K. I don't have a 4K player.
Well, exactly.
Right, because it comes with the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And the thing is, right, I've been tearing myself apart going, "Well, this is ridiculous. If I meet Paul McGann and want it signed, it's a metal steelbook. Why don't I just buy the Blu-ray and get the paper bit signed and put it back into the sleeve?"
Well, yes.
So save yourself some money and get the Blu-ray.
Well, my other problem, Michael, is because I'm on this marathon... I'm not going to get to... Well, strictly speaking, I'm only doing Classic Who anyway, which means I finish at Survival.
Oh, finish it, McGann.
But it means I can't watch the McGann movie finish for the 3 years anyway.
Yeah, finish it, it's Schalke.
Finish it, Schalke. Wow, yeah. Yes.
Finish on a high.
Yes.
Right,
yes.
Right. Okay,
First people in the country to watch Schalke Episode 3 on a cinema screen at that.
Right.
Oh,
so
yes,
that was my Morrison story.
Fingers?
Of course we can. Yes, they've got four fingers.
Why do they have square fingers?
Because it's influenced by Hellboy, and all of the Mike Mignola characters look like that. You can look them up. They've all got massive fingers,
and they're all square.
All squared off. It's weird.
It's just really weird. Yeah, it's very odd.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a homage to anyway. I think people were just having a nice time, and then they had a film at the end.
I think the thing that struck me was just how they got it made, because it doesn't feel like a Disney film at all.
It doesn't. It's got Disney at the beginning, and it's got Disney money, and it's got a song at the end, which is very lackluster, and that's it. It's done. But yeah. I don't know how it got made, but I'm very glad it exists. But I don't know. It's the sort of thing I just like the fact that it's exist, but it's just so not a Disney film. But
no.
There was talk of having an Atlantis ride in Disney World.
Right.
And there was plans afoot to have a sort of, because there'd been the Nautilus ride, okay, which was at which is now the Seas with Nemo and Friends kind of thing in Disney. So they've got the only place that's still got there's two Nautiluses still around in the parks.
Right.
There's one in Japan and there's one in Paris. And the Paris one is on purpose because obviously that's Jules Verne's based. But then they had Space Mountain, which was also Journey to the Moon themed. And then they took all that away and turned it into a Star Wars ride. Right. Now, sorry, I'm a big Jules Verne fan. Read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea as a kid. It's good. There's a huge history of filmmaking in France, the Journey to the Moon, all of that business, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And we've covered all this before because obviously, again, we're back to steampunk. But so in Paris parks, you've got that. And in Japan, which is a Disney park that doesn't actually belong to Disney because it was paid for by the Japanese, which is why it's the best park, arguably, and has one of the best lands.
I had no idea that Japan had a Disney park.
Oh my God, look up Tokyo. Watch some videos. I'll send you some links. It's an incredible land. It's just incredible. The Tokyo Disney and Tokyo Sea are, they'll just blow your mind. All of the stuff that's happening now that's good, like Frozen Land, they had it there first.
Right.
Because it's got its own IP, and I suppose Hong Kong's quite... Sorry, I know more about Disney parks than I really should, and I've not actually discussed this again.
You do.
But yeah.
Do you think it's anywhere on the roster of we're remaking all our animated films in CGI?
Not at all. Not at all. We could make this live action, but it just, no, I don't even think it's on anybody's list, because a lot of, I mean, like you didn't even know it existed, but you've got daughters, and you've had Disney Plus, so you were exposed to it. Now I know that when Verity was being brought up, I was like sharing my films with her, but the best Disney product by far are the Tinkerbell films, which were straight to video, and then eventually they came out at the cinema. So there was cinema, and then it was straight to video, and then went the back to cinema again because they were so popular. They've got the heart in the right place. They've got the world building absolutely done perfectly. Make a live action version of that, and I will come at you with a big brick, because because you're just wrong. Because they're just better. I hate them having to remake stuff in order to appeal to people.
There's no point in any... I mean, I don't think... Oh, no. I saw Aladdin. I saw Aladdin, and that was partly... Was that because it was on a plane?
Probably.
I can't remember. I think the only one that I've seen, and I don't even think I've seen the whole of it, is Aladdin. Because to me, there's no point.
No.
Right? There's no
but
point.
That's because you understand, appreciate, and like animation. Right, as part of who you are.
Yes,
and I
yes.
think there are some people who just can't handle animation. Not in their head.
I think particularly there are people, and I think this is true in the English speaking world, more so than anywhere else. But there's just a permanent association between animation and children.
Yeah.
I'd love to take anybody that I know to an animation festival and blow their mind.
Yeah.
Be like, here is some really grown-up stuff.
And we're not just talking like weird Japanese exploding schoolgirls and all that business. No, I mean,
the one that always sticks in my mind from one of the... So we went to Bradford as part of my course.
Mm.
It was part of... You had to go every year. So I must have gone in 2003, 2004 and... five, yep. To Bradford Animation Festival, which I think was relatively new at the time.
I was at the 96 one in Cardiff with Chris Ellis as part of my degree. So yeah, I've done the animation festivals, but
I forget which year. Anyway, one year there was this film, and it was basically about censorship, right?
Yeah,
and the way that this was conveyed was that all of the characters had their heads where their genitals should be and their genitals where their head should be.
Okay.
I'll be honest with you,
I've not seen this.
No, I can't say that I could recommend it. But, you know, I mean, that festival was a proper eye-opener to me because, you know, I mean, I was on board with, like, animation being a medium that went beyond cartoons for kids. But I was just like, wow, okay, there are people doing some really graphic... stuff, and you know, it was just fascinating to kind of see what people were producing. But your average person on the street has no idea, has absolutely no idea that animation has been, you know, and particularly in other cultures, you know, like the Czech.
Oh my God, the Czech stuff, yeah.
The Czech stuff, yeah. You know, obviously the Japanese, you know, like there's a very venerable tradition of making animated movies for grown-ups.
You'll have missed that whole resurgence of animation when Channel 4 first started, because they were looking for stuff to put on that was just off the wall. And they used to show a hell of a lot of very queer, very very odd stuff. I was going to say queer stuff, but queer in the sense of just odd and off the wall. All the time. It was, and they also made their own, like Murrenbush Steinzig and all of those things that appear on the Scarred for Life end of things. So yeah, I get it. But most people are like, it's Saturday morning cartoons. It's Scooby-Doo. It's, you know, it's the Cartoon Network. And if they do have a love of something, the most obscure thing they'll know is like Adventure Time or something like that, or SpongeBob SquarePants. So, you know, it's all designed primarily to make you laugh and designed or just to keep you made vaguely amused or just keep the kids happy or distracted. Oh, it's Bluey. Yeah. And I can't believe there's a kids program called Bluey, right? Because that's just... But,
Bluey is fantastic. Bluey is a fantastic TV show.
But I'm called Bluey, which used to mean dodgy adult film.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Right? It's like, oh, have you got any Blueys? Oh, yeah. Which I know it's because it comes from the Blue Book, and which because he used to have a comedy... There's a comedian, he had a red book and a blue book, and he's all his jokes that were dodgy and rude were in the blue book.
Right.
And it was like, that's why blue material came from.
There was a thing recently about Bob Monkhouse's notebooks being considered
my God, that poor man.
Beyond the pale.
Right, okay. As a film historian, we have a lot of respect for Bob, right? As a performer and someone who had an encyclopedic knowledge of... comedy history and comedy and timing and was just a consummate professional, love Bob, got a lot of time for Bob. He was the best host of Family Fortunes, and I'll take on anybody, and including Max Bagrius, I'll take on anyone who says otherwise.
Also, but he's in Thunderbirds Argo,
and he's in Thunderbirds Argo. What more do you need, right? Big fan of Bob. He had his massive video collection, which was absolutely the greatest achievement of his entire life, and they were like, oh, we're gonna have to burn these because they're somebody else's copyright. That put the willies up all the collectors. That was going to be horrible. And now his joke book, which was stolen once, have you ever looked into the stealing of Bob Monkhouse's joke book? That's something you can look up yourself anyway on YouTube, but that was stolen once. He got it back, and now they go, oh, it's a bit damaged. We should look after it. We'll take it onto the antiques program where they fix stuff, where J Blades isn't on anymore or whatever. And it's narrated by the bloke who was the space captain in Hitchhiker's Guide Series 2. Anyway,
Bill Patterson?
Yeah, he does the voice on that that antiques repair shop thing.
We've gone well off topic here.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, right. So, and then they fix it and they go, oh, yeah, well, let's read some of these jokes out. Some of these jokes, which are 50 years old and were funny at the time. Bob's material moved with the times. He reinvented himself and his comedy constantly. That's how he managed to stay at the top of his game for so long, right? And they're just randomly choosing old gags and they're going, oh, it's a bit much now. We can't say this. Even Bob would be like, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say this instead because I'm naturally funny.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, he would have changed his material with time. He would have kept his old stuff because he was a historian.
Yes.
Sorry, it's made me quite cross. It's not that Bob's like, oh, he's not politically correct. He knew he wasn't. He knew which bits to use, which bits he couldn't use, and he was always developing new material. He was very good. Sorry. That was me being a fan of Bob Monkhouse, which is not where I thought tonight was going.
Okay. How did we get here? Anyway,
I know.
Atlantis. Back to Atlantis. I think I wanted to like it more.
No, fair enough.
But I think I'm glad I've seen it, you know.
Yeah.
And because I think I've said this before, I'm not much of a Disney fan. I haven't seen a lot of Disney stuff.
Yeah.
And this, you know, we mentioned the black hole earlier, right?
Yeah.
This actually feels more of a piece with that, you know,
tonally. You're not wrong. You're absolutely not wrong.
Like, the black hole is properly disturbing.
Oh, God,
For a PG. Properly disturbing.
I saw the black hole at the Apollo Cinema in Biker with my dad when it was released. So are we talking 1979 or 1980? Possibly 78.
I think the black hole came out in 80, did it? Didn't it?
Okay, so in 1980, when it comes out, I am 8. I'm going to be confused. I'm confused by the ending now, and I'm 54. I was very confused, and also cried more at the death of old Bob than is legally allowable.
Oh, 79. There you go.
79, right, yeah. It's when they went, does anybody have anything that could match Star Wars? I've got this script. Yeah, we'll make that. Have you read it? Nope. It's got no ending. Doesn't matter. We'll make it anyway.
It's the fact that you've got the robot's called Max, and the actor who plays the dude is called Maximilian
Schell.
Maximilian Schell, and he ends up inside Maximilian Schell.
Yeah. Yeah, and the business with the blades. See, I still have nightmares. I'm doing the thing with my hands. It's great for podcasting.
What, you mean, but where it eviscerates Anthony Perkins off screen?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I did have the Black Hole Annual, which told the story of what happened when they made it out the other side of the White Hole. But that's not important. What is important is I had a Vincent. Oh.
It's a white hole. What is
Vincent's
it?
Vincent's not on my shelf of robots. I need a Vincent, man. I can put it next to BMO. Who have I got? Sorry, I'm looking at my shelf of robots, working out who's missing. That's quite scary. I had a Clockwork Vincent. Anyway, big fan of Black Hole. Makes no sense at all. The end.
And I suppose you can enjoy Atlantis on that level of going, I'm here for the spectacle. I suppose that's the thing. My wife and I were watching it on her laptop. So okay. I saw Atlantis on a, what is it, 12-inch screen.
Right.
So
as nature intended.
As nature intended. So slightly better than watching it on a plane. But actually, yeah, now I think about it, I'm like, actually, I would have been better off watching it down here on a bigger screen. And certainly, I can imagine as a cinematic spectacle. Like,
oh, it was
wow.
incredible.
Yeah.
Like, if you're in Odeon 4 and you're like three rows from the front, Jesus, it's impressive. Right, it was.
And I guess the other thing, that sort of mix of CG and 2D, you know, there hadn't been a lot of that.
No, the first time Disney uses CG for specifically, well, they call it a character, this is historically the one, is Rescuers Down Under, the sequel to The Rescuers. And it's a truck. They build a CG truck, like it's just a big vehicle. But it's got some characterization to it as well, because it's primarily used for backgrounds and for stuff like that. But it's definitely noticeable in it. But it's mainly the backgrounds and the panoramic vistas and the moving camera shots that they're doing with this. But as we both know, that would have been achievable on paper or using cell animation. It would have took some time and it would have been very labor intensive. But it could be done, especially if they'd done something with like a drop focus thing, which Disney invented. Disney pioneered, really. I wouldn't say invented, but you know what I mean? With the different layers and the glass shot. Which I don't know why, but I actually built one of those during my degree, and absolutely nobody noticed that the foreground was slightly more out of focus than the background. And I was like, this took me bloody ages to do, and nobody even spotted it.
We had one that had been, well, if we didn't, because obviously the thing with the Disney one is that the different layers could move up and down, right?
It's had a concertina
one,
thing.
Yeah, we just had one that had I think we had one that had three fixed layers of glass that were about a foot apart, I think. And so you could do, you know, but I to be fair, it's one of those things where, like, looking back, like, the cinematic was not an aspect of my animation course, you know. We weren't doing interesting things with cameras at all.
I was supposed to be, but you know what I'm like. I'll just try this.
The idea of, like, I mean, we basically had a video camera feeding into the software that could take frames. Yeah. You know, so it wasn't something where you could think, oh, I'm going to play with the depth of field here. It just wasn't. It was a case of, no, these are three layers that are pretty much all in focus, and we're just using them because you can then do interesting effects, which was great. I loved working with that. We did a whole piece with, you know, just scattering various things on the various layers and moving them around. There's various things that I'm like, oh, I wish I'd explored XYZ more, or I wish I'd known a bit more about certain techniques. But you've only got 3 years, you know. 3 years is not enough.
Well, I know, really, and I was very much at the wrong time. Everyone was like, oh, should we do computers? And I was really snobby at the time, going, oh, I'm a purist. I'm an idiot. If I'd gone down the computer route, and I would have been at the very beginning of that, I could have been doing it now. But I'm not.
I did the Maya stuff and the Cinema 4D stuff, I think it was Maya 5 when I started. So still quite early on. I don't know what version of Maya they're on now. You know, I cut my teeth on that stuff. I didn't pursue it as a career in the end. I mean, it's interesting, you know, with Blue Zoo being awarded the Doctor Who CBBS show. You know, I went to visit them because we had to do, as part of the course, we had to go down to London and arrange.
Offered yourself as a consultant?
No. I'd love to. It was a case of we had to do our own research. You'd kind of do a bit of Googling. To find animation houses in London and organise your own trip. So I went to Blue Zoo, and they must have only been like a couple of years old at the time. And I also went to Espresso, where they made the Frosties and Cocoa Pops commercials. You know, this was like 2003, top floor of, now what was it? One of the famous streets in London, I can't remember. But you've basically got these people. At the time, they were still, you know, light boxes, paper. You know, this was like Cocoa Pops and Frosties, and they were still being drawn. But I guess that's 23 years ago now.
Exactly. The last 20 years are all a bit of a blur. That's fine. Okay, shall we discuss cast? I mean, I know we kind of have in passing.
There are no Doctor Who actors to find, right? As far as I'm aware.
Now, according to the internet, there is somebody in this called Philip Morris. But it's a different Philip Morris.
Yes,
and that's the closest
that.
To a Doctor Who thing you can get.
Yeah, because it felt like his voice was familiar, but I looked him up and I was like, no, I don't recognise you from anything. No. It was well cast. You know, the voices were very well delineated. Having, you know, complaints about people's voices being too famous aside, it was very well done. People fitted their roles. You know, and obviously, yes, we had the Babylon 5 connection, we had the Star Trek connection, we had the Frasier connection.
We did. There's two Star Trek connections, actually, in this one.
Oh, who's the one?
Landis language was done by, I've written the name, Mark Aquad. He invented the Klingon language.
Right.
And he also did the Atlantis one.
Well, there you go.
Which is quite nice. There you go.
There you go.
But yeah, we've got the Star Trek one with Leonard Nimoy, and it is a superb performance from him.
Yes.
Because I think he's only, to my knowledge, he's only really done this, and I think he did Transformers as an animated voice type thing.
Yeah.
And that's, but this is just, it's like he's like in a different room to everyone else. He's saying, I'm just going to give this award-winning performance and no one's going to see it except me and the people in the audience. That's it.
Yeah.
And you're like, Jesus, that's good. Yeah. And then you've got the Fraser Dad thing. Yeah. So yeah. So there's no Doctor Who connections at all that I could spot.
What a shame.
Never mind. Right. Well, anyway, I'm glad I shared it, and I'm glad we've had a very nice chat about animation in general, which is nice.
Well, anytime we do anything animated, we can always talk
about
it.
We'll just
geek
out
back for
hours.
Yes. Animation, again.
Again, I know. They must be so bored. Right.
If they're bored of us talking about animation, then they... I mean, I don't want to lose any listeners, but you know, if you're bored of us talking about animation, then this is not the podcast for you.
Yeah, that's a good point, well made. Shall we discuss what we're doing next time?
Well,
I believe it's
it's my choice, but I'm gonna give you a choice of two things. I'm not gonna tell you what they are, but I'm gonna give you a description. Right.
Right.
So,
I'm listening.
You can either have a late 90s sci-fi action film.
Okay.
Or you can have an early 90s TV show that's set, sort of comedy drama set in the 1920s.
They were vague enough for me not to be able to guess either of them.
I mean, I'd be interested, listeners, whichever one Michael doesn't pick, do comment what you think it might have been. We will do it. We will, whichever one you don't pick, we will do the other one.
Let's
at some
do
point.
The 90s action movie.
90s action movie. Okay, we're doing The Fifth Element.
Oh, superb. Absolutely superb. I finally got an excuse to rewatch it.
Yes.
It's got the best opening 5 minutes.
And there are several Doctor Who actors to spot.
There really are.
Most of whom, a Hobbit.
Most
of whom hadn't been in Doctor Who when the film came out.
Right.
There's at least one who had in a... similarly potentially racially controversial role as he had done in Doctor Who, but we'll come to that next time. There's also a cameo from a Red Dwarf actor, if you know. I think you do. You know who I'm talking about when I say there's a Red Dwarf actor in it?
Like I said, I've genuinely not seen The Fifth Element for about 20 years.
Okay, right. So, well, I will send you a copy, and we can watch that.
I may have it on DVD. I may not. I cannot remember.
Well, I've got the Blu-ray. So if you want to watch it in HD, if you want to watch it in HD, please. Then I'll send you the HD copy.
We may already have it on Sky, but I will find it.
Yep.
I will have a look.
Cool.
That is brilliant. I'm not going to guess what the... Hang on. It's got a 1920s feel, comedy, sci-fi...
No. Comedy drama. Yes. But more comedy than drama.
All right, it's not The Stranger Is, then.
No. It's yes. But yes.
Let's other people guess. It's
other people can guess.
We also, might do it in one day.
Fine. Also has a lot of Doctor Who actors in it as well. And a lot of recasting of actors in a... Yeah. Anyway, we'll do that one at some point in the future.
Right.
But yes, fifth element next time.
The fifth element.
And we can also tell. We can also say. Leave it. We can also tell people what we thought of the Dalek's Master Plan. When we next meet.
We just need to tell them we're not having a watch party.
It will have. By the time this comes out in 5 days' time, it will have come and gone.
By the time this comes out, the people who've gone to the moon in the next 2 hours, will have gone round the moon and come back.
Well, thank you, Michael, for bringing Atlantis. It was enjoyable and very much enjoyable talking about it, regardless of what we thought of the film.
Exactly.
So, yes. Anyway, thank you very much. I will say goodbye and leave the final word, as ever, to your good self.
Be seeing you.